My dad, you know, who's 85 now, old Irish guy, I gave him a new iPhone back in probably like 2011 or something, right? He used to have an old flip phone. He's like, you know what this thing has? I'm like, yeah. He's like, it has a flashlight. Did you know this thing has a flashlight? And I'm like, I did know it had a flashlight. What? I told him it was replacing his flip phone. An iPhone doesn't replace your flip phone. Like, an iPhone replaces how you bank and how you order cars and how you do your social network, everything.
If you're on the fence about AI adoption, you aren't alone. It's easy to hear all of the hype, but when it comes to implementation, the reality starts to set in. So let's get your systems up and running. Our guest today is bringing people into the AI future, as well as shaping the minds that will redefine business. Connor Grennan, welcome to AI in Action.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, what is the chief architect of AI at NYU?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a new role because it's a very new field. So chief AI architect at NYU Stern is really responsible for elevating and upskilling the entire institution. So in the institution, obviously, we have students, we have faculty, we have administration, and we really want everybody thinking about this in a different way. It's one thing if you just have a new technology or a new system or something like that. That's pretty straightforward. You can just have IT obviously handle that. This is very, very different. So the role that I have there is really trying to figure out how to best upskill that entire institution.
How did you get this job?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of really cool stories I could tell you about that, but let's just go with the truth for now. You know, the truth is that I actually have no technical background, which is kind of unbelievable to have this sort of role with no technical background. But just to sort of bore you with a story real quick about this, in early, let's call it really early 2023, ChatGPT came out obviously in very late 2022, but I discovered this thing and went down this very deep rabbit hole of, you know, saying, hey, what is this thing? And then realizing like, wait, there's no bottom to this. And then the really crazy thing that I discovered as a non-technical person was, what do I need to know to really make this sing, to really make it operate well, to really be an expert in this? And so I started taking classes in machine learning, AI and everything, and soon realized that I didn't actually need any of that to be really, really good at it. So I very quickly built out a framework because my theory of work here was that this was going to transform everything. So this is very early 2023. So built out a framework to teach, you know, students and fellow administrators and faculty, et cetera. And in doing that, I also realized, well, wait a minute, I actually don't know how this is going to apply to different industries because I just don't know. It's such a new technology. So I would go out to kind of, you know, leadership teams around the city and say, hey, how are you using this? And the answer that kept coming back was like, oh, we're not really using it. And, you know, and I kept saying like, oh, you should check it out. It's kind of powerful. And they would say, well, can you teach us how to do it? And then we'll tell you what the use cases are for asset managements or hedge funds or healthcare or whatever it would be. So I would do that. I was like, great. I would go out and teach these leadership teams frameworks. You know, and after about an hour, they would say, this is going to transform everything. And I would walk out being like, Connor, you are the greatest teacher in history. And then I would go back maybe 3 or 4 weeks later and say, okay, you know, what do you got? How are you using this? I really want to teach our MBA students. And two answers would come back. This won't surprise you, David, but may surprise other people. The first answer was like, oh, we haven't really gotten back to it. You know, and I was like, what is there not to get back to? It's incredibly easy to use. All you do is talk to it. So that was one answer. And the other answer that would come back in the very minority, kind of the minority of people would be, okay, yeah, so you're right, it's amazing. And I was like, amazing, what are the use cases you're using? And they would say, oh, the use cases that you gave us. And I was like, but what the hell do I know about healthcare? Like, I don't know. Like, I Googled those use cases. Like, what are you doing? And they're like, no, those are great. So all that is to say that in the very, very earliest days, I think what I started to realize and started to build out and do a lot of research on at NYU was realizing this is different. And I couldn't figure out why, but that led us down this incredible path where we started to realize through a lot of research and just, you know, trying this with a lot of different organizations that this was actually much more of a behavioral shift than something you had to learn. And that's how I sort of got off and running on it.
Yeah, and that translated into your own consulting business.
Yeah, so that's what I do a lot now. So now I'm out and I'm working with a lot of large organizations, kind of like really across the board doing a ton of training for everybody. I mean, it feels like, you know, NASA and McKinsey and PwC we've worked with, you know, we're about to work with, anyway, a lot of companies that I can't name also, but just really in law firms and in retail and in healthcare and everything. And the crazy thing about that is that it applies, you know, this sort of system applies across every single industry because it has nothing to do with the industry. It has everything to do with how we think and how we relate to this technology.
So it's not the use case, it's just the technology. And really when it comes down to AI transformation, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's behavioral. Like the adoption of this technology is what a lot of the times is like the obstacle in order to get this technology up and running in industries.
I think that's it 100%. I think that what we've found is that it's so radically different, and I think people have a hard time getting their head around it. So we were talking about this a little bit off the air, David, but like, you know, one of the crazy things is that usually with technology, there's, you know, a learning curve associated with it. If you have to, or even anything, right? If you're learning like French or, you know, Excel or calculus, whatever it is, there's something where you have to learn it, right? And there's a moment where you have to, you know, figure out Excel and figure out all the things that come along with it, or just whatever you have to learn in another language or something like that. And what we've been finding here is that this has actually nothing to do with a learning curve. In the same way that if you wanted to get into, you know, better shape or something like that, right? Like, we generally know that we should probably like eat less and exercise or something, right? I mean, like, yeah, there's nothing to, right, in theory I'm talking here. You know, there's nothing to learn though, right? I mean, like, we already have the knowledge. The challenge is purely behavioral. The challenge is, can we actually change our behavior? And the problem is that this looks like a normal technology, but there's a lot that goes wrong with it, right? Because, and not because of the technology. The technology, is, as you and I have talked about, is very, very powerful right now. You know that better than anybody. So what is the problem? The problem is the adoption. The problem is that our brain, our very sort of like, you know, limited human brain, believes that this is something we have to learn. So we're literally using the wrong part of our brain to do this instead of using the behavioral shift and figuring out what will drive behavioral shift. And that's our sort of specialty, not just a TED talk saying, isn't that cool, like it's a behavioral shift. Like, how do we actually make that behavioral shift? But I think the big problem is that people are treating it just as another technology to learn. And as you and I were saying, there's nothing really to learn. You just have to shift how you work.
So that the first challenge you face, like when a client reaches out to you, the first challenge is like, you explain to them, this is a behavioral shift.
100%. And it's one of these things that is easy to say, but then how do you actually make that shift with clients? And I would say one of the first things that clients say is, hey, can you show us how this will work in whatever, you know, asset management or retail or something like that? And, you know, and in fairness, and I don't want to like out myself here, but I always say, yes, of course, we'll talk about that. And by the way, it's true, we will talk about that. But the reality is, and I think you know this, especially in what you do, David, is when I walk in, I'm like, you're going to tell me how this operates in your business, because you have to be the industry experts. You understand your business, all that kind of stuff. All we're doing is helping you shift. So in other words, if you had an usual kind of technology, you say, oh, how does this work in, you know, healthcare or advanced sciences or whatever, drug discovery, there usually is a way that a technology works in those different fields and it works differently. That's not the case with this. In fact, we go so far as to say, we don't teach in use cases. There's a lot of things we don't do that are sort of the typical ways of doing this. And we just find they don't work.
So you said before, when we were talking off the air, you said that this isn't a digital transformation. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, it's one of the first things I say to organizations that I go in and talk to. And the reason is that I think we're thinking that it is just the typical digital transformation. And if you think about a digital transformation, and I don't know who does it better than you all, you've done a million of these going all the way back, like you're the OG of digital transformation. I don't know if you actually invented the term. But with a digital transformation, if you put it into sort of like the very simplest, you know, elements of it, essentially you're taking an old technology and replacing it with a new technology. That's a digital transformation. And if you think about how that's done, again, in very simplistic terms, but you know, usually you sort of like give everybody this new technology, like, hey, here's our new, you know, CRM system or whatever it is, doesn't matter. And you have to force people to use it. So you actually, you know, give everybody training on it and you have mentors that tell people how to do it and you give people use cases about how to do it and you try to explain why it's going to be better and the vendor comes in, all that kind of stuff. And then importantly, you always have to, like burn down the old system because everybody's like, ah, the old CRM is so much better, right? Like, no, man, like, no, you cannot do that. But the point of a digital transformation is that you're switching out one thing for another. And what we found is that that's actually pretty easy on the brain, right? Because the brain does templates really well, right? It does like pattern prediction, things like that. So one of the things that I always think is interesting to show is like a slide of, you know, where it shows like ChatGPT reached 1 million users in 3 days and Netflix took this long and Spotify took this, all that. The interesting thing about a slide like that is with all these other things, your brain knows what it is replacing. And so you're just switching out, you know, going to Blockbuster for Netflix or using, you know, the old hotel system for Airbnb, whatever it is. And if you think about that, that you can take that technology all the way down to like the hammer, you know, replace like the rock, and the rock replaced like your hand. You know, I mean, essentially that's what a digital transformation is. It's switching something out, and your brain has no problem with that. It's like, okay, used to do it this way, now do it this way. But what if you came along and said, this is totally different? Like, this is the way that you think about everything. In fact, I would argue, what does a large language model replace? And by the way, when I ask that in big rooms, like, people are like, often, of course, as you can imagine, Google. It's like, yeah, kind of, but not really, right? And then the second one is always like, your brain. I'm like, no, what? No, man. Like, it doesn't replace your brain, but you know what I mean? Like, that's the instinct. So I think that's the difference between a digital transformation and what we have here.
So what's interesting about this for me, right, so we often work with, you know, customers who want to automate their workflows. They have these huge workflows and they say, oh my God, agentic AI, we could take this component, and replace that with agents. And the whole workflow would just be the exact same, except now agents are doing them. And this really hits on a point where you really have to think of, well, does this workflow even make sense in this new reality? We have this tool that can do much more, and anything you really, not anything you want, but honestly, kind of anything you want to do.
Pretty close.
You can replace your entire workflow. So it wouldn't even be a transformation.
Well, it's a transformation, I would say, is like kind of like taking A and replacing it with B. And this is more like a whole, as kind of you're going, like, it's a whole new way of working. So when my whole point about like the Google search engine and everything else is that when you think what you know what it's replacing, your brain sort of like locks that in. And you lock in the new way of doing things. It's sort of like the Henry Ford with like the faster horse. It's like, well, hold on. What if there was a totally different way of doing things? And that's what to me is so interesting, is like when your brain locks in, but like, I can tell this kind of quick story, but like when we think about a digital transformation and thinking about what something replaces, the problem with giving people, you know, agents is they're very, very powerful, but they also sort of mimic what we do already.
Exactly.
And I think what people are doing, and this is what you and I were talking about, I think, and I've heard you talk about this before, and I've always loved how you've talked about this, which is people are just very limited in how they think. And they're just using that AI agent to actually replace this other workflow. It's like, great, now I can spend an hour less rather than totally rethinking this. And the way I think about it is, just to kind of give you an analogy, if your brain doesn't know what a large language model replaces, it's going to come up with something pretty simplistic. So, you know, one analogy is I gave my dad, you know, who's 85 now, old Irish guy, I gave him a new iPhone back in probably like 2011 or something, right? He used to have an old flip phone. And I was like, Dad, here's your new phone. He's like, oh, it's kind of hard to hold. I'm like, yeah, I know, but okay, just try it. And he's like, okay. And I decided I'm going to let him just figure this thing out on his own, right? So it was like a week went by before he called, and I was like, what do you think? He's like, Connor, you're totally right. This new iPhone is like unbelievable. I'm like, right? He's like, you know what this thing has? I'm like, yeah. He's like, it has a flashlight. Did you know this thing has a flashlight? And I'm like, I did. I did know it had a flashlight. What? So point being, like, why did that happen? It's because I told him it was replacing his flip phone. An iPhone doesn't replace your flip phone. Like, an iPhone replaces how you bank and how you order cars and how you do your social network, everything. So I think what's happening that we're seeing with large language models is something has nothing to do with the large language model, everything to do with our brain, which is it's replacing something. And I think we're seeing the same thing, and you know this better than anyone probably, I think we're seeing the same thing with agents. Don't you think people are just using it to replace something rather than innovating?
A big part of this behavioral shift, I think, is to say, be creative. Look at this. Look at this tool that you have. Think about how you could reform everything you're doing with it.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And we see that over and over and over again. And one of the reasons we don't teach use cases is that people don't extrapolate on use cases. The problem is, if you're good at using a large language model, I'm guessing if people are listening to the show, a lot of people are good at this.
Yeah.
The problem isn't whether you know how to use it or not. You know how to use it. The problem is, can you get others to use it? And that to us is the holy grail. So when we think about AI adoption, what slows AI adoption, and I would even say brings it to a halt, we sort of see four things. And by the way, a lot of these we used to do ourselves. So just to sort of like run through them real fast. So the first one is, you know, the lighthouse case, like, oh, look what Walmart's doing, or look what IKEA is doing. That's not actionable, right? So forget how much ROI they're making. It doesn't matter if you don't know how to do it. The second thing is the tool rollout, right? We see this all the time. 10,000 Copilot licenses go on computers around the organization, right? And it seems great for the people who use Copilot. They're like, this has changed my life. Now it's going to change everybody's life. It would be like putting a treadmill in every house in America and thinking you're going to cure heart disease. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't matter how many features your treadmill has. I do have a treadmill. I mean, it's downstairs and I bought this thing and I was like imagining how I'm going to look in this summer. And my wife's going to be like, who's that guy? Right? I mean, like, you know, and yet all the features do nothing unless I actually get on the treadmill. And the reason I get off that treadmill has nothing to do with whether or not I know how to run on the treadmill. A toddler could figure out a treadmill. It has to do with whether, you know, what actually has to do with my limbic system prioritizing quick rewards and conserving energy. But that aside, rolling out tools like treadmills or large language models doesn't work because it's not something that people will naturally just like learn and then replace with something, right? So that's the second thing. The third thing is the use case problem, right? Again, people teach in use cases all the time. You and I see this all the time, right? So, and as you and I see all the time, people don't extrapolate.
No.
And the reason is, I believe, is that it's just too broad a general purpose technology. And so the analogy I use a lot is like electricity, right? Like nobody wakes up in the morning and is like, what are some use cases for electricity today, right? Like how can I make my life more productive using electricity? Right now it's a dark room and so you use electricity or you have to open the garage door, whatever it is, right? Except that with a purpose, you know, a general purpose technology this broad, everybody's stuck on like the light bulb. People are like, yeah, the light bulb, it's like, and you can use the light bulb to do all the same stuff, but now it's, you know, better lit, right? I mean, like that's the problem. And the last thing is, and this is what I was going for here, the AI champion. And by the way, we used to teach this AI champion model all the time. Like, hey, get people who are really good at it. They'll teach everybody else. It doesn't work. And it doesn't work. And this is the whole problem. Because again, it doesn't matter if you know how to do it. Does your team know how to use it? And not even know how to use it, but are they using it? And with the AI champion, the analogy I use real quick on this is, if you wanted to get your whole office healthy, right? Like you have a big team here and everybody seems great. But if you wanted everybody to do like, you know, yoga every morning and you wanted to get one of your team members to sort of, you know, say like, hey, you know yoga, teach everybody yoga. That person could teach everybody the moves, everything else. So at the end of the month, everybody would know all the moves, why it's healthy. But what they would not know, or what they would not do rather, is get up every morning and do, because one is a behavioral shift and the other is a learning curve. So that's why these things, I think, stall in real enterprise.
So you, when you go to a client, are you looking for the AI champion? You're looking for the person that you think, this is the person who's going to be able to affect change on this organization to have that behavioral shift. How do you find who that person is?
I think you have to find that person in order to bring everybody else along, but it has to almost happen after the fact. So for example, like I'll go in and do workshops with senior leadership teams. And one thing that happens a lot is that the senior leadership team will say something like, hey, can you come in and give us specific demos? Because I always do demos. Can you give us demos that are tailored to whatever, private equity or something like that, right? And I'll be like, sure. And so I'll come in and I'll do the demo. Now here's where it backfires. And here's where the AI champion has to come in. It'll backfire and the skeptics in the room, because you always have skeptics in the room of like a senior leadership team, you run into these folks all the time, right? And the challenge is that those skeptics will look at what I've done and say, but that's not a good answer. And now I'm stuck, right? Because I don't know if it's a good answer or not, because I'm not in private equity. And then everybody else is like, oh, but so what I do instead, and this is how I really recommend people run workshops, by the way. So sort of one of my trade secrets is like, get somebody on board before, right? Sort of say like, hey, I'm going to turn to you. And I'm going to be like, you know, John, tell me how you are using this. And that's the AI champion who's really absorbed it. And then we sort of like do it live together. But what they can't do is then walk out of that room and just get everybody else to use it, because the problem isn't whether people have the tool or understand it or anything like that. The problem is, how do you shift behavior? And that's the specialty we do.
That's amazing. First of your trade secret, it's going to come with me back to my, seriously.
Right on.
Because
right on.
We work a lot like that. Exactly. Like we sit in a room with a lot of people and we say, okay, what are your problems? We're the experts in whatever this technology is. And we're the ones who have to be kind of creative, but we're coming in from IBM and working with a customer. Internally, how do you foster that creativity within the organization?
I think that you have to train a wildly different way. I think that everything we've been doing, and I believe this very deeply, I think has been wrong. And I think it's proven to be wrong by the fact that we're almost 3 years into this whole journey. And still adoption, as you've seen and I've seen, is very low, right? I mean, like there's some organizations that are, you know, really killing it and doing some great work, but it tends to be sort of isolated, at least how I've seen it, right? So given all that, like how do we make that transformation? So what I do in organizations is first of all, point out that it is a behavioral transformation. But if I just did that, it would just be a TED talk, right? I mean, like, that's not actually that interesting. What's actually interesting is we have been using Google, for example, right? Like, for since the dawn of time, it feels like, right? The dinosaurs were using Google. And how do we use Google, right? So we look at this thing, it's a search engine, we give it a command, we get a response, we walk away. Now, the problem is when your brain actually sees this, your brain actually looks at this, the way neural pathways work, your brain actually thinks it's looking at a search engine in the same way that if you see like a baby, you wouldn't accidentally talk to it, you know, like a college professor, right? Like your brain works on visual cues. It just does things automatically. You can drive in the rain probably, right? And talk, have a conversation because of muscle memory. So that's what our brain is doing totally subconsciously. Now, if it looked like C-3PO or if it looked like a person or something like that, you would never do that. You would never sort of say, you know, to a person like, hey, give me the top 10 things to do in Costa Rica. And the person would be like, sure, where do you want to go? I've been there. Like, no, I just give me the top 10. You know what I mean? Like, you'd never do that. You'd have a conversation. The problem is your brain doesn't see this thing as a conversational entity. It sees it as a command response, walk away. And there's no way to fix that in your brain unless you start to build out paradigms and frameworks.
Dude, I had to do the same thing. So for example, before LLMs, before generative AI, before all these powerful tools, anytime I would deal with web chat, I would think, okay, what is the decision tree? What are the keywords I have to get to? I just need to get to this answer. So I would talk to it in like a single word, trying to get down the decision tree of the chatbot to get me to where I want to go. And now when we're building this out, like we have to, it's a behavioral thing. It's like, I could communicate really broad, like super broad. And you have like these agentic routing, like where I could just say like I'm very verbose and obviously. And so I would test it out, like when I was showing, like we were building out these applications, just like these huge verbose, like meandering statements, trying to get to the end result that I want. And amazingly, the LLMs and agents are able to get us there, which is, again, you would not anticipate that because you're so used to NLP, you're so used to decision trees, you're so used to this stuff. And that's something you have to teach people. Do you teach about using these powerful tools and not using them as a crutch? Like, because is that, as an engineer, as an architect, this kind of stuff, it feels like I use a tool that could help me write better code and I start using it and then I'm like, start using it a little bit more and I have to like scale back because all of a sudden I'm now relying on this tool almost totally to do a job that I am supposed to be doing. Is there anything that when you talk about the behavioral shift, is there anything that, like that that comes up?
There is. And I'm, by the way, dying to get your answer on this too, because what I find is that, you know, if I'm speaking to a big room or a team or something like that, I get asked the question almost inevitably, well, isn't this cheating? And I'm like, it depends. Like, I mean, if this was, you know, eighth grade and they were judging you on whether or not you could write this, then yes, it's cheating, right? But if your employer just wants a better output, I mean, you use Google and you use friends and you use colleagues and you're just, it's a resource. That's all. And what happens in law firms a lot, I work a lot with law firms. What happens in law firms all the time is that they'll say, well, it's a disaster because the junior lawyers are giving us things that are inaccurate. I'm like, then fire that lawyer. I don't mean that literally, but do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
The point is that everybody's responsible for their output. And now to your question about this, I'm struggling too, because I'm a writer by background and I'm finding myself like writing and I'm finding myself like just now instinctively sort of like checking with one of these large language models. And I'm like, okay, so what does that mean? I'm like, well, what that means very importantly, and the huge difference with students, why I don't think students should always be using AI, even though I'm an advocate, is students and young people have to learn the critical thinking skill. I already kind of know what good quality looks like.
What is the foundation that companies need to have before they start scaling their AI agentic workflows inside their organization?
Yeah, it's a good question because I'm guessing that with previous technologies, as you'd be more familiar with, obviously, this probably looked very different. It was more, you know, you have your IT solutions, you have your human solutions, you have all these kinds of things. And I feel like this is much more of a human solution than an IT solution. But the number one thing, the foundation, is whether your senior leadership team is totally on board, and not just on board, but really understands how to use it. So we do, you know, with my company with AI Mindset, we do like enterprise partnerships, right? And the thing is, we used to just train teams, which, you know, like, oh, can you come in and train our, you know, 200 person digital marketing team or something like that? And it was great and it would work. Because I think this thing is a great employee engagement strategy to sort of say like, hey, we're going to teach you. Like nobody takes Excel home and makes their life better necessarily, right? Like, I mean, like what you do with this can, you know, help you in your future career, your kid's future career, like help become a better gardener and spouse and cook, everything else, right? So number one, this is for you. But number two, like this should make your work easier and better, and it should bring you more joy at work. But what we were finding was something really interesting, which is if we would train teams, we kind of just thought, oh, this will be great. This digital marketing team will take off. But what would happen is they would essentially kind of like take their 8-hour day and make it into a 6-hour day because they could, right? That was number one. And then the other thing that would happen was, and we saw this in some private banks and wealth management places and some big places we worked with, which was shorter tenured people started to outperform senior tenured people. And that's just because they were using this tool and senior tenured people weren't using it. And so all of a sudden, like, you had 23-year-olds who seemed to be outperforming the actual people with the actual knowledge inside your organization, which is a disaster, as you were talking about, right? Because you need that brain. You need to augment something. Because that person in the short term can just say, like, hey, look how well I'm doing. And their product is amazing. But if you start testing them on it, they don't actually really know what they're talking about. In both those cases, it wasn't systematically hitting revenue. So when we think about the foundational thing, we now first exclusively work with leadership teams. If we're going to work with an organization, we have to, because the number one thing, and McKinsey data has verified this as well, but we saw it anecdotally for a long time, is your CEO using this? And I don't mean like, do they know what it is? I'm talking about like, they spill coffee. Are they, you know, taking a photo of, you know, the rug and be like, oh no, you know, how am I get this out? Like that level of whatever, right? So they have to know that, but also they have to set new benchmarks for the organization. They have to know what a new 8-hour day looks like. They have to know essentially sort of like what a new structure of an organization should be. And then really, to your point, well, one other layer of that is they have to do talent evaluation. They really need to know, because if you just see people spitting out AI stuff and it looks really good, that's disastrous. You need people who know what they're doing to be using AI. So what we work with organizations on is start with like your job descriptions. You know what I mean? Start with who you're hiring, because that's the low-hanging fruit of restructuring in a way, right? It's like, don't bring anybody on board if AI agents that are being produced here can do 60% of that work. So I think that that's really critical. But all that sort of like bundled together is the senior leadership team needs to understand deeply why and how this is going to change every single role in the organization.
So making the leadership the AI advocates within your organization seems like it would just supercharge like the moving forward with AI adoption, which is, I think, is, I don't know if that's counterintuitive or not, because a lot of times technology sometimes bubbles up from like the dev level all the way up to their manager.
Exactly.
Like, I'm like, listen, I tell my manager, you got to try this tool out. We got to talk about this. This is amazing. This is going to change everything. But my manager's okay with it. My manager's, we're in a tech, AI tech company, basically. But I wonder for other organizations, like having that advocacy coming from the top, really, that's where you think we should start.
That's what I've seen. And I haven't seen anything else work. And the reason is that, first of all, companies have to start moving from encouragement to expectation of use, right? Because if you think about it, like you would never, like if you had an accounting department and just three of the people in your accounting department were like, yeah, I'm kind of done with Excel. Like I'm just going back to pen and paper. You'd be like, no, what? No, man, like you got to use Excel. Like that's not a, you know, that's not, it's not optional. But the problem here with this is that it's very hard to track whether people are using this or not. So all we've done so far is encouragement. It's like, come on, guys, like this is going to be great for you. And look at all these use cases. Give us your use cases. This is why I don't do use cases, right? Because even when you go deep and you teach everybody use cases, the problem is the human psyche. So here's how we sort of see it. Most of America, maybe the globe, I don't know, is going from point A, starting their day, to point B, which is the end of the day. And a lot of the world just wants to get to point B. They want to go home at night. Like they don't need to learn a new technology. They don't care. They're not in, you know, IT. Like they don't care about technology. They don't like it. They've never liked it, whatever. And you can say, yes, but look at all these things that you can do throughout the day. Look, and they're like power-ups that you can grab along the road. And what we've realized is that doesn't drive adoption in an organization. It takes the people who are already probably excited about it and helps them. But that's not how you drive adoption. And as you were talking about early before we got on the air, this is really differentiation of an entire company when you do this, right? So the way that we've been thinking about it of late is, well, what if we instead, and this is what we do at AI Mindset, instead of sort of like thinking about this as encouraging people to use use cases, what if you bake it into processes that cannot be avoided? So if you imagine that point A to point B, that road, imagine putting a roundabout in the middle that people have to drive through it. Imagine that's a meeting or whatever. And imagine that you then make every meeting, and we have ways of doing this that I think are really effective, it's stipulated that AI has to be used, and there's a very specific way that it has to be used. I don't think you'll ever have a meeting of five people, I'm sure you've discovered this as well, where when somebody doesn't bust out a large language model and say like, hey, here's some ideas, nobody's ever like, get that out of here. You know, like, hey, like, no, they're like, that's pretty good. What else could it do, right? So you have to sort of like start moving in. And I think that that is the huge thing with leadership, moving this needle instead of it coming from the bottom. Yes, it comes from the bottom. Yes, there's a ton of organic ideas, all that kind of stuff. I think the way that it comes from the bottom is when we start talking about future of work, right? I think that the future, I think the history of work has always been defined by the creators of the technology, right? Like if you create, a camera or a microphone, you're like, okay, here's the people that need to create, build this and here's how you use it, right? Those are the people that define it. But I don't know about you, but that's not how I'm seeing it. I'm wondering how this works with agents now specifically, because I think even if you go to the IBMs of the world or the OpenAIs or the Amazons or the Googles or the Microsofts, they don't know how this technology should be used. Leadership doesn't know how it should be used. And instead, I think the only thing you can do, and this is what we do, we upskill an entire organization. We have like a digital course and all that kind of stuff. So we do this, at scale, tens of thousands of people. And you just let everybody go. Again, not teaching them how to do it, but changing behavior. Because then what we've seen anyway is like leadership is like, they're just sort of watching. And then like over in the corner of like building six, there's like a team of three doing the work of like 14. And you're like, it's like very like Heart of Darkness. But like, you're like, how is that person like, like bringing back this many tusks or whatever it is? Like, you're like, what are they doing over there? And you go over and you're like, and they'll tell you what their process is. And then you try to imitate that process. But I'm wondering how that would work with agents as well. Do you know what I mean? Like that process of, will some people figure it out, or how do you guys think about it?
So we have something called the Watson X Challenge.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Right? We have like 25,000 teams of people.
Oh my gosh.
No, it's crazy.
That's insane.
And you're incentivized to come up with an idea, build out the agent, and then you're ranked, and then you go,
I love it.
Go through levels. And that was a way to get my manager to be like, hey, let's write an agent together. Or to talk to somebody who's, business technology leader. They're not like technical, but they're like, they start to think about how these agents can affect the way they do their work. And all of a sudden they're like, wait, can we build this out? And we can, of course. And that's how you, in our experience, at least in IBM, is like you just have people, you get people to the three people who are coming back with the most tusks from building six. Mm-hmm. That's how you find it in IBM, because you have so many people working with it. And it's been huge. I mean, agents changed everything for me. Agents are, they're able to call tools. They're able to do like things that an LLM wasn't able to, like functional things. And now you're using the LLM, I think, as its strongest, which is just a way to interpret what you're saying and turn that into action. The idea of orchestrating many agents to do a task.
Yeah.
Because you think about like, okay, you're cooking, right? Let's say you wanted the entire workflow to be agents. You have the shopping list, you have the, before you even get to the shopping list, you have to come up with the recipe and then all this other stuff. And you'd have those as individual agents that are orchestrated. And that, I think, is the future. I think the future of simple agents that do a particular task and they're just accessible to this supervisor that's able to understand what you're trying to do and able to route you to the things that you want to do. I think that really is where we're coming, like where we're going with agents, just the orchestration of them, and they're just this massive amount of very simple agents. And that's, I think, is going to be really an interesting way of communicating with this user interface. When you have this anticipation that the thing you're interacting with has all of these competencies. Like it's able to do, shopping really well. It's able to do recipe building. It's able to do cooking really well, like understand all these things. And I think you have to get people to understand that that's what's really, it's not like you're not just talking to ChatGPT, you're talking to a million different sub-agents.
Right. And the reason I love that too is that in order to really understand that, you have to understand what the brain feels like. And this is why we want to sort of like, and not, I mean, I don't mean our brain, I mean the brain of like the large language model, meaning when we talk about agents, I think there's still this assumption that they're just an automatic machine, which like an automatic mail sorter or a calculator, which does the very extremely predictable, the same thing every single time. And the beauty of agents is that no, it can actually do more. It can process through how you talk to it and everything like that. And that's the exciting thing to me, is to watch the evolution of agents. And as the underlying language models get smarter and smarter, that they make, I don't want to say they make fewer and fewer mistakes, but that is part of it. But also they can just intuit what you need better. And even if that starts with a very small thing, the orchestration of a lot of those things, it allows people to start thinking not just in terms of replacing one task, but like, how could this task be totally reimagined?
Are there any red flags that companies should look out for before they actually take this AI plunge?
Yeah, I think, the expectation is the big red flag. I think that as you guys do maybe better than anybody else, but if your data isn't in good shape, then there's not a ton you can that's not true. There's a ton you can do, but you're not going to be able to pull the right data at exactly the right time. And I think that we see that a lot. And I would even bring that down to the microscopic. I mean, it's this whole term around context engineering, which I know you know well. It's like less about like, oh, what's the great prompt that you put in, and more like, where is this pulling this data from? So I'm not saying go out and, reinvent your whole data system. Although, if you can, if you have the resources, by all means, I think that's best practice, to be totally honest.
At this point, yeah.
But it really is a phenomenal investment, even though, yes, it costs a lot. And you guys do this, I think, really, really well. But there has to be an expectation, which is if you have just, you know, kind of even garbage, not garbagey data, but data that's unlabeled everything else. The problem is large language models are so now so good at pulling unstructured data that it almost fools us into thinking, well, if it can do this, it can do this. And even when I'm like demoing things on stage, various tools and things like that, I sometimes just can't get it to pull the right piece of information. And that is really, really hard. And if you can't do that predictably, you're really hamstringing yourself. Like, I mean, there's a lot of things that people could do, but then they all have to be fantastic individually and all have to understand that. I think you're just going to have too many people in your company who need to do something kind of like automated. They're not going to be your big thinkers, all that kind of stuff. There's no, and by the way, those people are probably not listening to this podcast in fairness. But without that, you really have to have your data in phenomenal shape. And I think the big red flag is to think that if we just slap an awesome large language model on top of this, it's going to sort it all out because it's gotten so good at that. But the mistakes, if you need to be precise, and a lot of organizations really need precision,
absolutely,
that's going to blow up in their face.
This is a problem people are running into and that they have to really, really consider. So the data problem, I think, is foundational to every enterprise before they move and they start taking this kind of stuff.
It's so right. And I love the way that you frame that around the orchestration layer as well, because so masterclass, I'm doing the new masterclass right now.
Nice.
We just finished filming, which is awesome. That's coming out now. But one of the things I was doing in that was talking about trust and hallucinations. Cause I think what we think about when we think about hallucinations, you know, hallucinations are just going to, you know, when did the Golden Gate Bridge move to Connecticut? It's like, 1952 or whatever, right? Like that's not even the biggest problem. The biggest problem I think is what you're articulating, which is you can usually spot a crazy hallucination. What is harder to spot is, first of all, the sycophancy problem, which is when you're saying like, is this a good idea? People are like, oh yeah, it's a great idea, right? So like, that's the second part of trust. And then the third part of trust was, what if the data isn't the right data? So in other words, like if you say, hey, I want to create a new HR tech company, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's like, help me do some market research. And these large language models will pull something that looks amazing until you say, when did you get that data from? Right? It's like, this is from, you know, October 2022. You're like, okay, so let me stop you right there. Right? So the third part of this trust thing and the hallucination problem is not whether it's giving you the right data, all that kind of stuff. Is it timely? Is it the right data? Is it the better version of that thing that you created? And that's sitting in your data. But these things don't know because they don't think that way. So I love when you think about like orchestration, context, and everything else. When we can crack that code, that's it. Like then if we can, and I don't know how to, that's your job. good luck with that. But like how it knows what to pull and when to pull it.
Connor, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It was really, really a tremendous pleasure for me. To all of you, thank you for watching. We have more AI in Action available on YouTube. Make sure to go check out more of the best names in tech. We'll see you soon.